Chapter 2. Lyrical Prelude.
Alex was a very inclusive kind of guy, right from the word go. Ken Grant, teenage friend of Alex Campbell.
The child is father of the man. William Wordsworth, The Rainbow, 1802.
People who know Alex Campbell intimately describe him in consistent terms. When asked about her husband's character, Marilyn Campbell points to his outgoing personality, his easy way with people, and his sense of humor. She adds that Alex sometimes carries that a little too far with his practical jokes. Campbell's sisters, Virginia and Harriet, say that their brother, whom they knew as Sander while growing up, was always very, very fair. Referring to an early family photo, they say that it shows their brother Mel to be energetic and Alex attentive. "We always called him Lucky," they say. "If he's driving through the village and his boat trailer on hooks, he just slows down and it catches up. He was always ready for an open door." Campbell's firstborn son Blair recalls boat trips and pranks at the family's Stanley Bridge cottage. During Christmas retreats to Stanley, the children looked forward to the opportunity to speak to Santa over the CB radio. They would giggle at the qualified promise, "We'll see what Santa can do." Alex Campbell's boyhood friends describe him as good-natured and quiet, more likely to be listening than speaking. "You knew that when Alex had something to say, you listened," says Wyman Miller, who threw second stone on Campbell's 1952 schoolboy championship curling team. Wyman remembers Alex as even-keeled. Maynard Skuerman, who started in grade one with Campbell and considered Alex his best friend, says, "I watched him grow. Everyone loved him." Paul H. Skuerman says, "Alex was always jovial, a diplomat, never out of sorts with anyone." George Dalton, who was several years younger, recalls that Alex enjoyed a form of quiet respect. Campbell's 1952 high school yearbook, The Emblem, describes Oop as tall, dark, and handsome, and includes a futuristic sketch referring to members of the graduating class, one of whom was Chief Justice Campbell.
Lineage.
Alexander Bradshaw Campbell was born on December 1, 1933. On the face of it, this was not an auspicious time to be delivered into the world. Canada and the global economy were in the depths of the Great Depression, which would be followed in quick succession by the Second World War. Notwithstanding the troubles in the larger universe, for the young Alex Campbell, this was a lyric time, to grow up as a good-natured, well-intentioned, active, and by times mischievous youth in Summerside, Prince Edward Island. As Prince Edward Islanders might put it, Alex Campbell came from good stock. His parents, Thane A. and Cecilia Campbell, were both natives of Summerside and descended from established island families. Thane Campbell was a scholar. He won the Governor General's Medal at Prince of Wales College and obtained two master's degrees, first from Dalhousie University, and a second one from Corpus Christi College, Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. Thane taught languages for a brief period at Ridley College in Ontario before returning home to Summerside, where he read law with former PEI Premier A.C. Saunders. By the time Alex was born, his father was a Liberal MLA for the First Prince District, elected in 1931, and was considered an up-and-comer on the opposition benches. In July 1935, before Alex turned two, the Island Liberals won an historic electoral victory, capturing all 30 seats in the provincial legislature, the first clean-sweep election in the British Empire. Liberal leader Walter Lee was ill throughout the campaign, making only one public appearance. Thane Campbell was considered to be the deputy leader during the campaign, and following Lee's death in early 1936, Campbell became premier. He served for two terms before stepping down to become Chief Justice of Prince Edward Island in 1943, an office that he would hold for 27 years. Prior to becoming Chief Justice, Thane Campbell maintained his legal practice in Summerside. He also served as Secretary Treasurer and Manager of the PEI Mutual Insurance Company, a role that had been filled by his father Alexander Sandy Campbell, going back to the insurance company's founding in the 1880s. Alex's earliest Campbell ancestor on Prince Edward Island arrived in 1775. James C. Campbell, a native of Perthshire, Scotland, emigrated on the ship Elizabeth, which was caught in a storm and shipwrecked on nearshore sandbars as it approached New London Harbour. All passengers save one made it safely to shore. James C. Campbell married Eliza Townsend. They and their descendants became involved in farming, shipbuilding, politics, insurance, and other business ventures, including a Summerside liquor store and travel agency operated by Alex's grandfather, Sandy. Alex's mother, Cecilia Bradshaw Campbell, also came from an early colonial family. Her Bradshaw ancestors moved to New Brunswick from Massachusetts in the 18th century and became shipbuilders. Cecilia's grandfather, Harrison Bradshaw, set up a medical practice in New Glasgow, PEI, in the mid-1800s. Her father, Melville Bradshaw, moved to Summerside, where he worked in the coal business of Joseph Reed and Company, and would marry Reed's niece, Aletha, and take over management of the business when Joseph Reed was elected as Liberal MP for Prince County in 1917. Cecilia Bradshaw attended Acadia University, where she studied home economics while excelling at basketball and expanding her interest in fine arts. Upon graduation, Cece, as she was generally known, worked for a time in Rhode Island in the 1920s before returning to her native Summerside, where she and Thane Campbell were married on February 28, 1930.
Home life.
Thane and Cecilia Campbell established their Summerside home at the corner of Winter and Summer Streets in the Fanning House that had been the home of Alex's grandparents. It was in this home that Alex's older sister Virginia was born in 1931. Alex followed in 1933, and his brother Melville, known as Mel, arrived in December 1934, just 12 months younger than Alex. Their youngest sibling, Harriet, was born in 1940. The Campbell family was tightly knit. Alex and Mel were as close as brothers can be. They were near enough in age and size for their mother to transport them in a double pram and dress them as twins. Alex and Mel often wore matching outfits, such as sailor suits, and entered grade one in the same year. Cece Campbell made sure that her children were well turned out and ran the family home with a creative flair. Thane added linguistic playfulness, referring to the boys as the Bougies or Bougie Bimbos and the girls as the Girlies. Even the family cars had names, such as Bluebell, as the Campbells' Plymouth sedan was known. Alex was known as Sander at home, unless he was in trouble, in which case he was Alexander. It was not until school years that he was known as Alex. As an adolescent, he had the nickname Alley-Oop, after a popular cartoon caveman. This was generally shortened to Oop by his friends. At home, Mel was known as Beb. Along with the linguistic inventiveness in the Campbell household, there was precision about language. Thane Campbell would protest highway signs reading "drive slow," and playfully chastised the children for using the one-word expression perfect, insisting, "There is no such thing as perfect." Meals commenced with an abbreviated version of the Latin grace given at Corpus Christi College, Oxford, and Thane Campbell regularly offered greetings in Gaelic at Scottish cultural events. Cecilia Campbell was creative and artistic, a collector of decorative arts, glass, textiles, ceramics, and period furniture. She was a well-appreciated cook and ran a lively household. Outside the home, she was active in IODE and Girl Guide circles and encouraged women's involvement in curling. The family dinner table was elegantly dressed in festive or seasonal mode, including by times a miniature scales of justice that Cecilia would reach out and adjust if she thought the conversation had become too one-sided, on occasion declaring that it was time for some girl talk. Boy talk could be about curling or other sports. Politics were rarely discussed in the Campbell household. The family was occasionally joined at the table by Alex's imaginary friend, Charlie, who might have an opinion on the issues under discussion, or would occasionally ask through Alex for an extra helping of potatoes. Alex Campbell has fond memories of his early years and family life. "I could not have chosen better parents and siblings," he says. "In spite of difficult times, my early life was comfortable and full of adventure and discovery. Mel was my constant companion. We were close enough in age to share common interests and friends. We also suffered bouts of earaches and knew the comfort of our mother's arms and favorite rocking chair." For the Campbell children, life in Summerside revolved around home, school, church, and winter activities, such as building snow forts, taking rides in Mr. Walker's milk sleigh, or Mel and Alex going off in search of the family Christmas tree. Christmas was a highlight. Everyone contributed to making the Campbell home one of the best decorated in town. There was always a steady flow of friends and visitors. Weather permitting, they maintained a backyard rink. The family barn was a popular center of activity, including a boxing area and a supply of costumes and clothing. Both Campbell parents encouraged the children in music. Cece Campbell played the piano and enjoyed singing. Thane took the boys along to practices of a community male chorus. Alex recalls that his father loved to sing. Thane Campbell had a distinctive bass voice, read music well, and could play the piano. He was a long-standing member of the choir at Trinity United in Summerside, where Alex would later sing. Alex says that his father was a very strong influence on what would become a lifelong affinity for group and choral singing. Many years later, their shared love of singing would come back when Alex visited Thane in an Ottawa hospital, where his father lay incapacitated and speechless as a result of a major stroke. At a loss for a means to give comfort to his ailing father or to communicate with him, Alex started singing one of Thane's favorite hymns, Unto the Hills, based on the 121st Psalm and composed by John D. Campbell. To Alex's amazement, his speechless father sang along.
Unto the hills around do I lift up my longing eyes. Oh, whence for me shall my salvation come? From whence arise? From God the Lord doth come my certain aid. From God the Lord, who heaven and earth hath made.
A major milestone came with the 1938 construction of a family retreat at Stanley Bridge, named Bellagio, for an Italian town near Lake Como that Thane and Cecilia visited on their honeymoon. Cece Campbell oversaw the construction and had a hand in making the floor coverings and drapes. The entire house reflected her artistic influence, including a collection of antique glass often referred to by the children as Mother's Junk. The family spent the entire summer at Stanley Bridge. According to Alex's sisters, "We didn't do vacations, really. We did Stanley Bridge." Harriet says, "Stanley was Mother's Haven." Alex's longtime friend Maynard Skuerman recalls being invited to Bellagio, saying, "Cece Campbell was in her little kitchen singing Shoe Fly Pie and Apple Pan Dowdy. She was a great cook. She was a fine lady, my soul." Maynard's invitation included working in the elaborate tiered gardens. Thane Campbell was a fiendish gardener, he recalls. If you missed a weed, you'd hear about it. It was not uncommon to see Thane Campbell working in the gardens in shirt and tie, or with a book of poetry in hand. During the war years, the Campbell children would compete to have the best weed-free Victory Garden. For Alex, Stanley was a world apart, a refuge where he spent the most enjoyable days of my youth. Campbell's earliest memories are of Bellagio being built when he was 4 years old. Alex spent his time at Stanley roaming the woods, building and imagining trails and forts, swimming and boating, or making rafts with Mel. Grandfather Bradshaw's boat, Melalisa, was popular for river cruises and picnics. Alex notes that, "Once we became familiar with the sandbars and shoals of the river, Mel and I were allowed to operate the boat and look after its maintenance." Alex worked by times at the Woolner farm next door and had his first summer job with local fisherman Robert Murphy, who took tourists out deep sea fishing. Alex received $2 per day, recalling, "I began to feel a growing sense of independence as my earnings piled up." Stanley Bridge became the family sanctuary. Grandfather Bradshaw built an adjoining guest house for Cece Campbell's sisters, Emma Holman and Harriet Blair, and their families. The cottages became the scene of many family gatherings, highlighted by weekend picnics and regular skits and performances. The groundskeeper, Jim Hiscott, was a legendary jokester and storyteller. The house was alive with laughter, including when the Bridge Club would visit. Thane and Cece Campbell hosted various special guests and organizations, including Commonwealth groups, the local Women's Institute, the Royal Canadian Legion, the Trinity United Church Choir, and members of the provincial legislature. A highlight was the annual gathering of the New London Campbells. The steady stream of visitors also provided an opportunity for mischief. Alex says, When our legs were long enough, Mel and I would occasionally test drive a visitor's car without getting the approval of its owner.
Beyond home.
Alex retains vivid memories of two early ventures outside the Campbell home. In 1939, when Alex was 5 years old, King George VI and his wife Queen Elizabeth visited Charlottetown as part of the first ever tour by a reigning monarch to Canada. As premier, Thane and Cecilia Campbell had official duties to perform. Virginia, Alex, and Mel were invited to join their cousin Helen Holman on bleachers erected on North River Road for viewing the royal parade. Alex was asked by his mother later that evening about his impressions of the king, and is quoted as responding, "He sure looked good on his motorcycle." The young Alex wasn't much older when Clara, the Campbell family's longtime maid, took him to see his first movie featuring Shirley Temple. He was so enchanted by the young starlet that he insisted on meeting her backstage after the show. He recalls, "I reluctantly left the theatre disappointed and teary-eyed." Perhaps this was a forerunner of Campbell's penchant for going to the kitchen at the end of political meetings to thank the ladies. Alex was smart. He didn't have any trouble in school, although he didn't consider himself a scholar. He had difficulty reading as a youth, to the point of developing a fear of oral reading when the teacher would ask students to stand up and read for the class. Alex says that over time he developed a capacity to get the gist out of what's on the page and relied mainly on his memory to get by reasonably well. Everyone thought of Alex as affable, a joker, but not the loudest one in the crowd. Ron MacArthur, his longtime classmate and friend from the age of 5, remembers that Alex always had a big, big laugh. Alex was sparing with his words. Classmate Gerard Dalton recalls that before Alex said something, he would give it a lot of thought, saying, "Even a simple thing, he'd hesitate." Campbell was 11 when the Second World War ended. During the war, there were air raid siren practices, parades, and other displays of military preparedness, along with victory bond drives and the knitting of mitts and socks for Canadian fighting forces. The most visible sign of the war effort was the establishment of the air base at Summerside. This was in no small part related to the fact that Defence Minister James Ralston had been elected to represent the Liberal-friendly Prince District in a January 1940 by-election. The Summerside Air Base became home to hundreds of pilot and navigation trainees from all parts of the Commonwealth. The youth of Summerside enjoyed a weekly visit to the recreation centre at the base, transported by a bus that would come into town to pick them up. Alex Campbell's memory of VE Day on May 8, 1945 is vivid. He recalls, "A Lancaster bomber flew at full throttle over our school." As Alex and Mel became engaged in sports, Mel demonstrated an aptitude for more rugged activities, while Alex's preferences were for badminton, floor hockey, track events, golf, and curling. Alex was the fastest runner in his class. With the teen years came hobbies. Alex began to collect stamps and took up photography, converting an attic closet into a darkroom for processing. Alex and Mel were both fascinated with automobiles. Alex says, "When we would travel with the family, Mel and I competed to be the first to ID an approaching vehicle. We knew most of them at a distance by make and year." Alex recalls, "As we grew into our mid-teens, we were becoming aware of the wider world around us. We were allowed limited use of the family car, which would take us to local square dances and to the homes of friends." Ken Grant was a year older than Alex and hung around with him as a teenager. When asked whether Campbell was an introvert or an extrovert, Grant responds, "Neither really. Alex was nicely balanced, warm and open. He had lots of friends, a narrow circle of very close friends. Alex could charm the socks off almost anyone. He liked people for what they were. He didn't pay any attention to ethnicity or religion. I suppose he got that from his parents. And he was Sean Connery type of handsome." Whatever else people recall about Alex during his growing up years, no one fails to mention that he was good-looking. Alex became active in Cubs and Scouts. He participated in summer camps at Fernwood on the Northumberland Strait near Bedeck, in annual sessions that might last a week or 10 days, and in winter hikes across the ice to Holman's Island near Summerside. Frank Costello, one of the leaders at Fernwood and of the provincial scouting movement, led an elite camp known as Qualla Walla at Holland Cove, near the mouth of the Charlottetown Harbour. Alex attended Qualla Walla, as did Joe Skuurman, who recalls, "That's where all the serious scouting took place." For Alex, scouting was a first opportunity, in his words, to make friends beyond my immediate community. In 1949, at the age of 15, Alex was one of 33 Island Scouts selected to attend the first Canadian Boy Scout Jamboree in Ottawa. Frank Zakin of Charlottetown was troop leader of the PEI group. He says that no one caused him any trouble. For many of the scouts, it was their first time off-island. Zakin recalls being mystified by all that gray soil. More than 2,500 scouts from across Canada took part in the Jamboree, which was visited by Governor General Viscount Alexander and international scouting leaders. Ivan McKenzie, who was a year ahead of Campbell in school and would later serve as scoutmaster in Summerside at the same time as Alex, says that the Jamboree plus the travel and preparatory activities gave all of the participants an opportunity to really get to know each other. The island group developed a strong sense of camaraderie that continued through subsequent reunions. Later in 1949, Alex received his King Scout Merit Badge, the fourth Prince Edward Islander to do so. Alex had an early brush with competitive curling in 1951, when his father Thane recruited Alex, Mel, and Wyman Miller to play on a team skipped by Thane in the annual Confederation Bond Spiel in Charlottetown. Miller recalls, "We were a bunch of kids, really." To their amazement and to the surprise of competitive curlers in the provincial Bond Spiel, they made it to the final game and won, capturing the Wellner Cup. Miller says, "We were pretty pleased with ourselves." He remembers that Thane Campbell, who was an experienced curler and a 1974 inductee into the Canadian Curling Hall of Fame in the builder category, was beaming from ear to ear. In 1952, Alex's schoolboy curling team won the PEI Provincial Championship, defeating his brother Mel's team in the elimination game. At the National Championships in Moncton, Alex and his teammates won three games and lost six, with three of the losses coming down to 1 point or decided in extra ends. Second Stone Wyman Miller says that, apart from Alex, they didn't have much background in curling. Asked whether Alex was hard to get along with as skip, Miller responds, "Oh no, he was a good skip and a good player. He studied the game, and when he called a shot, we didn't question him." Joanne Skuerman, who grew up in Moncton, recalls that during the national tournament, the word got out among the teenage girls to get over to the curling rink to get a look at the island team. She says, "They were a handsome group, and Alex stood out." Campbell says the experience as skip was good preparation for cabinet government. You would ask people to make shots that played to their strengths. Campbell's schoolboy team went on to win a further coup at home, winning the 1952 senior championship at the Summerside Curling Club. Alex didn't get into much trouble at school or cause much. Corporal punishment was considered a normal part of the educational process, with teachers regularly using the strap and occasionally throwing a punch in aggravated circumstances. Ron MacArthur has a clear recollection of a grade 7 incident, which he recounts to illustrate how Alex was able to stay out of trouble. MacArthur and Alex were seated near each other, as they were through most of their school years. During an extended absence from the classroom by teacher Ruth Croken, they unscrewed the rods that held their desks together and commenced sword fighting. When the teacher returned, they were caught in flagrante. Miss Croken rushed down with an urgent question that Ron MacArthur says he'll never forget. "Did he hurt you, Alexander?" Campbell responded, "No, he didn't hurt me." At that point, MacArthur says the teacher took me up to the front of the room and beat the hell out of me with the strap. Alex went unpunished. He was obviously well-liked by his teachers, too. In high school, Alex was active in student affairs, including as a representative on student council. In grade 12, he drove a cab after school or on Saturday when Tessie's taxi was short a driver. He also served as leader, or akela, of a wolf cub pack. In a 2011 interview, Campbell reflected on the fact that he, in his words, kept falling into what might be called leadership roles. He does not recall actively seeking or campaigning for group or peer recognition, although he concedes, "You can certainly see a pattern all the way through." Perhaps the most significant pattern emerging from Alex Campbell's school days and youth is captured by his recollection that, "I had a lot of friends and few enemies."
Summerside.
Summerside was a good place for a gregarious youth to grow up in the 1930s and 40s. There was an intimacy that came with scale. The town had a population of around 4,000 during Alex Campbell's early years and grew to 6,500 inhabitants by the 1951 census. The air base was a significant factor in the growth. George Dalton notes that Summerside was a walking town. If young people were going to school or to a hockey game or to the wharf, they walked. They went in and out of each other's houses. The Dalton place was like Yankee Stadium in summertime. There were numerous outdoor ice rinks in winter. Gerard Dalton recalls that the Campbell's Barn had all kinds of secret entrances and an attic at the top and was a gathering place. Gerard was once taken by Alex to a turret in the Campbell house. He says, "We were kind of going around without his mother's approval. For a kid, it was a world without boundaries." Among the imaginary boundaries for young people was a demarcation among East Enders, West Enders, and Hillers, the latter of which referred to the newly developed north end of town. There was a further classification for those who lived in the area between Granville and Central Streets, where the Campbell home was located. This was generally known as the center. These associations were mainly playful, helping to define alignments in sports. Paul H. Skuurman, an aficionado of Summerside sports history, says, "It wasn't really much of a rivalry. We looked out for each of the districts. It might have been half a summer or something, and then it disappeared. For boys, it was a neat way of organizing their world." Leigh Skuurman was an East Ender and a competitive athlete who saw the main rivalry as being between the East and the West End in hockey and baseball. He says, "The center and the Hillers could go together, but they didn't have such a strong team." In Summerside, the part of town where you lived tended to line up with social class. While times were tough in the 1930s, and resources had to be carefully managed during the Second World War, there was money in Summerside, at least for certain families. Through its history, the town had seen three boom periods: shipbuilding in the mid to late 19th century, fur breeding and trading in the first three decades of the 20th century, when Summerside became the world headquarters of the silver fox industry, and national defense, notably with the establishment of the air base at nearby St. Eleanor's. Beyond the booms, the town was a commercial hub for the western part of the province, with department stores, banks, insurance companies, car dealers, and other services, plus shipping in and out of Summerside Harbor. The people who lived west of Central Street in Summerside were mainly working class and less well off. In the 1930s and 1940s, many of them were poor. Summerside's Acadians were generally West Enders, constituting a sizable minority, approximately one-third of the town's population. Acadians gravitated to Summerside from the fishing and agricultural communities of Prince County to find work in the service sector or as manual laborers. Many of the maids and domestic help in wealthier homes were Acadians. There were Acadian businesspeople and elected officials, including Oban Arsenault, who became premier in 1917, Henry Wedge, who became Summerside's first Acadian mayor in 1950, and Frances Perry, the first woman elected to town council in 1962, who later served as mayor. Alex Campbell's seatmate and Minister of Finance, T. Earl Hickey, was descended from a leading Summerside Acadian family. Among Alex Campbell's early clients when he set up his law practice was Harold Goody, an Acadian businessman who was generally considered to be one of the wealthiest people in town. When Campbell's schoolboy curling team went to Moncton for the 1952 National Championships, Goody drove them over in his late model turquoise and cream-colored Cadillac and shepherded the boys during the bond spiel. The schoolboy curlers still recall that, as they disembarked from the car ferry at Cape Tormentine, New Brunswick, Harold Goody instructed them to call him Mr. Godet, using the proper Acadian pronunciation, not Mr. Goody, as it was pronounced in Summerside. For Summerside, the real contest was not between East Enders and West Enders, but with Charlottetown. This was especially true in sports, and it was not uncommon in other realms of activity, including politics. George Dalton describes the Summerside-Charlottetown rivalry as a chronic bun fight. Summerside was different from Charlottetown when it came to religious distinctions. While people took their faith seriously and there were plenty of strictures, especially when it came to dating and marriage between Protestants and Catholics, there were fewer lines of institutionalized segregation. In Summerside, there was a single hospital. Summerside's Wolf Cubs and Boy Scouts were organized by community organizations, notably the Wise Men, whereas in Charlottetown, they all had church affiliations. In Charlottetown, the coffee shops, recreation centers, and young people's hangouts were religiously identified. In Summerside, they weren't. Summerside's business culture helped to encourage collaboration. In a small town, business and professional people with a mixed clientele were not inclined to alienate customers. Summerside had a non-denominational public school, which Alex and his siblings attended from grades 1 through 12. Catholic boys would take the first grades at the St. Mary's Convent School and then move to Summerside Elementary, where they studied together with the Protestant boys and girls. Catholic girls generally attended St. Mary's throughout their grade school years, although some transferred to the public school in the upper years. They went on to convents such as Notre Dame Academy in Charlottetown for grades 11 and 12. In Charlottetown, by contrast, Catholic and Protestant students were segregated throughout elementary grades and high school, a segregation that was mainly replicated in the teaching staff and administration in compliance with a gentleman's agreement reaching back to 1877. For Alex Campbell, the inclusive example started at home. When asked whether sectarian differences were a factor in his upbringing, Campbell reflects openly, "Not that I was ever able to define it or even understand it. As we'd be going to church on Sunday morning, we'd meet the Daltons and the Deans traveling in an opposite direction. We knew they were going to a different church, but then you'd meet the same people as friends in school on Monday morning, and no thought was given to any religious affiliation. I think it was just a gray area, one that I didn't fully understand." Alex's father, Thane, would be invited in 1965 to be the first non-Catholic to serve on the board of governors of St. Dunstan's University, a telling acknowledgement of his perceived ecumenical values.
University.
When Alex Campbell went to university at Dalhousie in the fall of 1952, his horizons were expanding. It was his first time living away from home. When it came to his studies, Campbell says that he hit a brick wall. He discovered that the good memory that had gotten him through elementary and high school was not enough for the rigors of university. He learned some quick lessons in cramming, developed his note-taking skills, and devoted additional hours to his studies. Plus, he relied to an even greater degree on his memory. Campbell says of his choice to study arts and law, "I'm not sure whether it was by default or by design, but it was the natural way to go. There was no moment of epiphany." During his first year, Alex lived in residence at Pine Hill Divinity College, as did many Dalhousie students. He roomed for 1 year with future New Brunswick Premier Richard Hatfield, who had known Alex's sister Virginia while studying at Acadia. Campbell does not remember discussing politics with Hatfield, saying he doubts whether either of them knew where they were going. He was elected as first-year arts representative on Dalhousie Student Council and became active in the Sigma Chi fraternity. Alex rose to become consul, or president, of the Dalhousie Phi Rho chapter and lived for several years at Sigma Chi House. Alan Sullivan, who would go on to be Nova Scotia's Attorney General and Minister of Health in the government of Gerald Regan, also lived there. Through Sigma Chi, Alex met Andrew Mackay, a football star with the Dalhousie Tigers who would go on to be a law professor and Dalhousie University president and later a Federal Court of Canada justice. Alex considered Mackay to be a role model, describing him as a born leader, easygoing, friendly, brilliant student, and a great all-round guy. Alex had a brief stint at debating, but says that he was an absolute flop, unable to think on my feet. That's not how Ken Grant remembers it. Grant was studying medicine at Dalhousie during the same years that Alex was in law school. He says that he attended a dance for what is known at Dalhousie as Monroe Day. He recalls, "They had this guy come up to address the crowd. It was Alex. He was a natural speaker. I thought he had them in the palm of his hand." Campbell found the environment at Dalhousie to be quite ecumenical. A Jewish friend took him to synagogue, and he frequently attended United Church services, sometimes with a girlfriend. Alex spent the summer of 1953 in flight training with the Royal Canadian Air Force, but decided that a career as a pilot was not for him, and the rest of the summers during his university years were spent working as a traffic agent with Maritime Central Airways based in Charlottetown. This enabled Campbell to spend time at airports throughout the Maritimes, filling in for vacationing employees, including stints at Goose Bay and Labrador. While Campbell says modestly that he did not excel academically and was just happy to get a pass and get by, he graduated on schedule with his Bachelor of Arts in 1955 and his law degree in 1958. In the final years of law school, he started to feel a small sense of urgency about what he was going to do as a lawyer after graduation. While classmates were making commitments to positions with law firms, here I was still enjoying the life of a student. Campbell articled for 6 months with a Halifax firm before deciding that he had little interest in living in a city, and made arrangements to complete his articles on Prince Edward Island with longtime Summerside lawyer Richard Hinton, QC, becoming a member of the Prince Edward Island Bar on February 16, 1959.
Launching career and family.
Campbell opted to set up his own law practice, soon to be joined by his brother Mel. Alex cobbled together office furniture and started out doing his own secretarial work. On the day he opened his law office, he had three visitors. Two were insurance salesmen, and the third was a poll worker from the 2nd Prince District who came to see if Campbell would be interested in being a candidate in the 1959 provincial election. He demurred. Over the next several years, the legal practice grew to become a going concern. With the Progressive Conservatives in power, both provincially and federally, there was no government work for Liberal lawyers. In addition to their primary office in Summerside, Alex and Mel purchased a former meat shop on Main Street in O'Leary, a mainly agricultural community 40 minutes west of Summerside, and converted it into a one-day-per-week law office. The biggest event in Alex's life came when he met and then married Marilyn Gilmore. Her parents, Melville and Rilla Gilmore, along with five children, had moved to Summerside with the Air Force, following stints in Belleville, Fort Nelson, and Calgary. Marilyn's father was a senior officer responsible for facilities at the Summerside Air Base. Marilyn was strikingly good-looking and witty, but shy. She worked as secretary to Dick Henthorne, a manager at Holman's department stores. Alex and Marilyn met on January 1, 1960, at the Summerside Curling Club and hit it off quickly. They didn't talk politics when they were dating. Politics had never been discussed in Marilyn's family. It apparently did not work to the detriment of the courtship that 1960 was one of the worst winters in many years for snowstorms. After Alex had been storm-stayed at the Gilmore home at the Air Base on two consecutive weekends, Cease Campbell suggested, "Why doesn't Marilyn get storm-stayed at our place next weekend?" She did. Following their marriage on August 1, 1961, Alex and Marilyn Campbell settled into a modest bungalow on Summerside's Maple Avenue in a neighborhood of young families. It was not long before their family grew in number, with son Blair arriving in February 1963, followed by daughter Heather 15 months later in June 1964. A third child, Graham, would arrive in January 1969. Alex and Marilyn belonged to an active circle of young couples on the Summerside scene, many of whom became lifelong friends. Their fun was in simple things, such as camping or moving from house to house with other couples to watch the Stanley Cup playoffs. Alex was recruited into the Summerside Wise Men's Service Club by Charles Linkletter in 1961, becoming club president in 1963. The women had their own organization, the Wise Menettes, and Marilyn was an active member. For Alex, there were many opportunities to get involved in community service. He served as Secretary of the Board of Trade from 1961 to 1965, became Scoutmaster of the 1st Summerside Troop in 1960, and sang in the Trinity United Church Choir. Not least, there were monthly, sometimes twice-monthly, fundraising drives for public service and social welfare organizations in the days before the United Way.
Political involvements.
Given Alex Campbell's family background and his involvement in community affairs, it was inevitable that he would be eyed up for the multitude of tasks involved in electoral politics. He proved to be a willing volunteer, with an almost incessant pace. Between 1959 and 1965, Campbell would be actively involved in three federal elections, two provincial elections, a federal nomination contest, and a 1965 by-election that saw him elected to the PEI legislature. The fortunes of the Liberal Party on Prince Edward Island and in Ottawa were at their lowest ebb in more than a generation. Federally, the Diefenbaker government had been elected with a minority in 1957, ending 22 years of consecutive Liberal government under Prime Ministers King and Saint-Laurent. The Federal Conservatives won a record-setting majority in 1958, sweeping all four PEI ridings in both 1957 and 1958. With a provincial election imminent in 1959, many considered the handwriting to be on the wall for Prince Edward Island's Liberal government. The Liberals had been in power continuously on PEI since 1935. Premier Alex Matheson delayed calling the election until late summer, opting to go to the polls on September 1st. The opposition Conservatives had a new leader in Walter R. Shaw, by then 71 years of age, but sprightly and a strong performer on the platform. Although only in the first months of establishing his legal practice, Alex Campbell agreed to play an active role in the 1959 election campaign of Fifth Prince Liberal candidates Morley Bell and Ed Foley, the sitting MLAs. On September 1st, the Conservatives took both Summerside seats and elected 22 MLAs in total to gain a strong majority in the 30-seat legislature. Alex Campbell treated this as a learning experience about the downside of politics as well as the upside. In the 1962 provincial election, Campbell agreed to be district campaign manager for Fifth Prince. The Shaw government was re-elected with an 8-seat majority, and the Conservatives won both Summerside seats. The 1959 and 1962 election campaigns were mainly dispirited for the provincial Liberals. For Alex Campbell, they were opportunities to learn about the need for effective ground organization and a strong and loyal team effort. Campbell also got involved with the Prince Edward Island Young Liberals Association when it was formed in 1959. He was named to the executive as the Prince County representative. As far as Campbell was concerned, the decision to get involved with the Liberal Party was biological. He said, "On Prince Edward Island, in those days, you were born into your political party in the same way that you were born into your church." Campbell's politics weren't all along straight party lines. The lunch counters at Summerside department stores were popular gathering spots for young lawyers and businessmen for morning coffee. Steadman's and Smallman's tended to draw different crowds, although Alex frequented both. The talk among regulars often turned to politics. There was always a mix of Conservatives and Liberals. The animated conversations were a good training ground for a future MLA and Premier. When the discussion turned away from politics, it might have been to sports, including harness racing, and Alex's investment along with six others in Josiedale Co-Pilot. Ron MacArthur, who was one of the investors, says that the horse wasn't worth four dead flies, but we had a lot of fun with it. That was Alex's one and only plunge into the world of harness racing. In the June 1962 federal election, Alex was asked to organize the Summerside polls for Liberal candidate George MacKay. MacKay, who had served as highways minister in the Matheson government and was a leading figure in the provincial opposition caucus, made it a condition of his candidacy that there would be no liquor or bribes involved. Campbell still recalls his amazement to see, as the polls closed, that several carloads of respectable Liberal partisans sat out front refusing to vote because they were not offered a treat. It is said that the 1962 federal election in the Prince riding was the beginning of the end of the practice of offering liquor in exchange for votes in Prince Edward Island. MacKay was not elected, and the Diefenbaker Conservatives again swept all four PEI ridings. When the Diefenbaker government was defeated on votes of non-confidence in February 1963, Alex Campbell was persuaded, notwithstanding hesitation over what it meant for his young family and fledgling law practice, to seek the nomination for the Prince riding in the ensuing April election. The other main contender, out of seven seeking the nomination, was J. Watson McNaught, who had been MP from 1945 to 1957 and lost the traditionally Liberal seat in 1957 and again in 1958. Campbell lost the nomination by one vote, later commenting wryly that at least two of his supporters were out in the parking lot. Much later, Campbell remarked, as have others, that it would have changed the course of history if he had won that federal nomination. It also taught him the importance of every vote. Campbell took the loss well and served as McNaught's campaign manager, making speeches on his behalf at political meetings throughout Prince County. McNaught was elected over Conservative candidate Lauren Monckley and served in the Pearson cabinet as Solicitor General and later as Minister of Mines. That he served as campaign manager for McNaught underscores Alex Campbell's view that political rivalries should only go so far, a belief that he would display throughout his career. Campbell was also a firm believer in the benefits of a good political contest, telling Liberal Party historian Wayne MacKinnon in 1971, I always find that in any leadership convention, or even a nominating convention, it is much better to have a contest. Following the 1963 election, Campbell was perceived to be the go-to person for people seeking access to McNaught. This was a frustrating experience for the young lawyer, who had no more access than anyone else. He would line up at McNaught's modest office above Willard McDonald's garage on weekends or when Parliament was not sitting, and wait for as long as 2 hours to see the MP whose campaign he had managed. That he served as campaign manager for McNaught underscores Alex Campbell's view that political rivalries should only go so far, a belief that he would display throughout his career. Campbell was also a firm believer in the benefits of a good political contest, telling Liberal Party historian Wayne MacKinnon in 1971, "I always find that in any leadership convention, or even a nominating convention, it is much better to have a contest." Following the 1963 election, Campbell was perceived to be the go-to person for people seeking access to McNaught. This was a frustrating experience for the young lawyer, who had no more access than anyone else. He would line up at McNaught's modest office above Willard McDonald's garage on weekends or when Parliament was not sitting, and wait for as long as 2 hours to see the MP whose campaign he had managed. The 1963 federal election would have a further consequence for Alex Campbell. When Lauren Monckley became the federal Progressive Conservative candidate, he resigned as MLA for Fifth Prince. It took almost 2 years before Premier Shaw announced in early 1965 that there would be a by-election on February 9th. After some initial reluctance about the timing, Campbell sought the Liberal nomination and was unopposed. At an enthusiastic nominating meeting, Liberal leader and former Premier Alex Matheson told the audience in his customary direct fashion, "There are those who say that the Liberal Party cannot be returned to power under my leadership. Now you have nominated a man who can take my place, but you must elect him." The race was expected to be close, with an editorial in the journal Pioneer predicting, "This Fifth Prince fight looks like a thriller." The Conservatives selected businessman Claude Ives at a contested nominating meeting. They lost no time in announcing, following a meeting with Mr. Ives, the construction of a long-sought all-weather highway from Miscouche to Albany. The Liberals countered by sending Alex Campbell a telegram from Ottawa, announcing that the federal government would rebuild a runway at the Summerside Air Base at a cost of $1.5 million. In disclosing what he called the good news of the runway reconstruction project, Campbell commented that this could be interpreted as a commitment that the air base would remain in Summerside indefinitely. The Conservatives selected businessman Claude Ives at a contested nominating meeting. They lost no time in announcing, following a meeting with Mr. Ives, the construction of a long-sought all-weather highway from Miscouche to Albany. The Liberals countered by sending Alex Campbell a telegram from Ottawa, announcing that the federal government would rebuild a runway at the Summerside Air Base at a cost of $1.5 million. In disclosing what he called the good news of the runway reconstruction project, Campbell commented that this could be interpreted as a commitment that the airbase would remain in Summerside indefinitely. The Fifth Prince by-election was one of two to take place on February 9th, and the stakes were perceived to be high. The governing Conservatives touted their record of road building, school construction, health centres, homes for the aged, and development of industrial parks. Campaign advertising highlighted the lengthy community service and military record of PC candidate Claude Ives and the opportunity for Fifth Prince to have an MLA on the government side. The Liberals emphasized Alex Campbell's youthfulness and featured his photograph in ads and flyers. Emily Brown, who was a secretary at the Campbell and Campbell Law Office and would go on to work on many campaigns, recalls that all the mature ladies were in love with Alex. One-on-one canvassing was a major aspect of the campaign, and Alex Campbell excelled in learning the names and circumstances of individual voters. On February 9th, Campbell achieved a majority of 73 votes over Ives, picking up most of his margin in the surrounding communities of Sherbrooke, Miscouche, and St. Eleanor's, while pulling even with Ives in the town of Summerside. A February 10th editorial in the Charlottetown Guardian congratulated the Liberals on winning both by-elections, thereby tightening up standings in the provincial legislature to 17-13. The editorial assessed Alex Campbell to be an able campaigner and unquestionably a man of promise. For Alex Campbell, this was the culmination of a 31-year prelude to public life. The Guardian editorial writer spoke for many with the conclusion, "His entry into public life is a matter of widespread interest."